Welcome to the Truth Be Told presented by your Youth Initiative High School. Yeah. I want to thank each and every one of you, you know, everyone involved in the school. Thank each and every one of you for being here and threading the needle and supporting one of their biggest fundraisers of the year. You know, when Casey first approached me about being the MC, the first things that came to mind actually was MC Hammer and Young MC. I wasn't sure if that's what they were looking for. I can rap, and I'm not going to do that right now. These guys know I can. I can't dance. I don't have those parachute pants. And I have some big shoes to fill, too. I don't know if Grant Hicks is here, but he's done it a couple years, and he's a wonderful human being. So I had some big shoes to fill. I wasn't quite sure, and I said, well, what the heck? I like talking to people. They need somebody, so let's do this. And so they called me the master of ceremonies, the MC, but I'd rather, I feel better being your host. Kind of like Mr. Rourke on Fantasy Island or Captain Steubing on the Love Boat. Casey was supposed to get me a white suit and a black tie, maybe a tattoo or something like that. But unlike fantasies on an island or on a cruise ship, we're here tonight to hear some true stories from some real people, and it's going to be awesome. And so, let's get this started. Our first story is from a woman you have seen around town, or if not, then one of her many children, or possibly maybe you have met up with somebody to have coffee or gelato in her shop. The story of her, or the title of her story is called How I Got Here. Please welcome the wonderful Amy Petrozzini.
Wow, it is blinding. So I was told not to read off paper, but I'm really nervous, so I brought it with me. Okay. Anyway, threading the needle, threads and needles, bringing things together. Oftentimes when people say threading the needle, they think of doing something with precision, something well thought out, balanced. I've never really been well thought out or precise. I suppose I'm more literal. When I hear threading the needle, I think of sewing a garment, a quilt, a jacket, a skirt, getting pieces of fabric and stitch by stitch, bringing them together, making them one. This is my story, a small collection of how I got here. Much of my life, I've been mostly alone. And I say mostly alone because I grew up in Chicago, surrounded by millions of people. When my mom moved away, I would go days on end without being seen or spoken to. Chicago is so big, you can go to the same place at the same time every day and rarely see a familiar face. My introverted part loves the anonymity. My extroverted part does not. Sometimes I really love people, threads. When I was a kid growing up, we always traveled to my Aunt Joan's house for Thanksgivings, Christmases, Easters. There'd be lots of food, lots of family, lots of noise, lots of chaos, in a good way. The food brought us together, threads. We'd hop in the station wagon and we'd drive about 12 hours to Princeton, New Jersey. My dad would teach us songs along the way, and we would sing the same song over and over again and drive my mom up the wall. When we got there, we'd go inside and we'd say hello, and after a little bit, my dad'd be like, who wants to go for a drive? So we'd all hop back into the station wagon and we would drive to the Little People's Forest or the university and walk around. Then we'd get cappuccinos or hot chocolate or go to Hoagie Havens and get sandwiches or ice cream. My mom moved to Australia when I was 10. I would occasionally visit her, but I mostly lived with my dad and two of my brothers. This could have been a close thing, but it wasn't. My dad worked 7:30 to 7:30 most days, and my brothers would let me hang out with them and some of their friends Not so much before as a teenager, though. So I just wandered the city alone. High school, I did a lot of arts. We did sewing, painting, drawing, cooking. My friends and I, we would eat together, hang out together. We'd walk around the lakefront, the zoo. I had that sleepover house, the hangout house, for a couple of years. When I was 15, my dad took me to a boarding school in Arezzo, Italy, in a vineyard right outside of Arezzo, Italy. It was beautiful. I went willingly. When I got there, it was towering sunflowers on one side and fields of grapevines all around. When I got in, it was a shock. They did a strip search. They took all my clothes, my music, my books, my cigarettes, which was great because smoking is terrible for you. That school was a therapeutic boarding school run by some folks in California, a place called CEDU. It was a lot more than I thought it was going to be. So that night, I ran away. I slept in the bushes by the train station for two nights trying to figure out what I'm going to do next. I decided I'd go to the police station and tell them these people had my passport and I wanted it so I could go home. Needless to say, they brought me back to school and drove away. So I was in trouble for running away, and I was put on what is called bands and work detail. Nobody was allowed to look at me or talk to me for 3 months, except for when we were in group, which was 1 hour twice a week. I wasn't allowed to go to school. I had to do work detail. So from the morning until dinner time, I did meaningless tasks, like I had to de-weed a driveway that was so long it took you at least 10 minutes to walk to the end of it. Nobody cared. Nobody ever got out of their car to look at that driveway. Anyway, I was there over a year, and I made some amazing friends there. At around the year part, we ran away to Florence, a group of my friends and I, and we were there for a week before they found us and brought us back. When we got back, they wanted to put us all on bands and work detail, and we said, no, we're not going to follow these rules, and we wrote up an organized letter of demands of how we wanted to change things. We organized group walkouts into town. Our cohesive chaos pretty much closed down the school. I moved back to Chicago a bit before 18. At 18, I was asked to leave home. So with my brothers and some friends, we went road tripping. We went to visit various communes. We bathed in the river. We ate in the park on our camp stove. We went to Spokane and Seattle, and then ended up in Bend, Oregon, living in our van by the river. For the next few years, I went from Chicago to Oregon, different parts. Having kids at a young age was more isolating than I thought. I loved my kids. I love my kids. But when I first had kids, all the other moms were at least 15 years older than me. And at 21, that felt old. And now it's the flip. I have a 3-year-old, and I'm at least 15 years older than any of the other moms I know. Back then, I didn't realize that we were probably all in the same emotional state. We needed someone to support us who had families and babies. At the time, they seemed so well put together and so different than myself that I didn't reach out. It's really hard for me to reach out, but I love the community, and I'm still trying to do that now today. When I first moved to Viroqua, I had just left my full-time job at Starbucks, which was great because I wanted to be around more. My kids were starting school here. Mag was going into 8th grade, Oren into 6th, Nanuka into kindergarten, and Isla was still at home with me. It was very different here. And change and growth can be very hard. I loved Viroqua at first, but it started feeling very isolated. My husband at the time worked all the time, and it felt lonely. I didn't really know where to go to find community and where to connect. My mom was luckily here, so my mom and Isla and I, we would hang out in the park or we'd go to the library. But it was hard to connect. Threads. I started dreaming of a business once I was in Viroqua, at the little tobacco warehouse, not the either big ones, but that little one. And I thought, oh, I could put a cafe with couches and stuff in there, and we could do like an aerial art studio and a capoeira studio, and there could be apartments, and I could get all those people that I knew in Chicago to move here and teach classes, and then it's sold, and it seems like it's been empty ever since, although supposedly there's something there. I'm not sure what, but I never stopped dreaming of that place. These are just snippets of my threads that brought me here. I've always tried to create my lifestyle a home, a family, a community. I've loved having big family. I always wanted a huge family. Not just my blood, but anyone that I connect with that has integrity and love and respect and gives it back. COVID was a hard time, but apart from the illness and all the fear that everyone had, I really loved it. I loved being at home more with my family again. And that's when we created Magpie Gelato. I wanted that place that we could all come together, play games, read books, do music, where people were allowed to just be themselves and just sit and be, and then be with other people at the same time. I've been told this is sometimes called the third place, not home, not work, but the third place, the place you go and gather. And I guess that's where I'll leave you, with a snippet of my life and how I got here. These are some of my threads and my needle. I love my people, I love my community. I hope to keep making connections and expanding our energies. See you around.
Our next storyteller here, let me find my place, is a former Pleasant Ridge teacher. Former teacher and present day photographer, writer, and blogger. Proud husband of Jerry, and father of Leo, class of 2015, and Ivy and Sylvie. His sole purpose in life is to make the world a little better, but he needs a lot of help from all of you. The title of his story is called Life as a Camel. Please welcome Drew Shanka.
Well, this phrase, threading the needle, takes me back to church. From the time I was born into my young adulthood, every Sunday morning, I sat in the pew at one Catholic church or another, and most of that time I was bored. Much of that time I was distracted. But I tell you, if you hear a story or certain stories enough times, they stay with you. And one of those stories is coming to me tonight as I relate it to threading the needle. This is the story of Jesus who is approached by a rich man. There's a guy, he thinks he's got it all. He hears that there's one more thing that he doesn't have yet, and he goes to Jesus to ask about it. Master, what must I do to go to heaven? He wants that. And Jesus, he gives a pat and incomplete answer. He says, yeah, just follow the rules. The guy says, oh, you mean like the Ten Commandments? Don't murder, don't steal, don't take the Lord's name in vain. Jesus says, yeah. The guy says, well, I already follow all those, so we're good, right? I'm in? And Jesus says, one more thing. Go and sell everything you own and give the money to the poor. Then come back to me and we'll talk. Well, the guy walks away deflated, sad. He thought he was going to get that one more thing, but he doesn't want to trade what he's got now for something that may or may not happen in the future. And if it does happen, it might not be that great. At this point, Jesus turns to his friends and he says, you know, guys, it's harder for a rich man to go to heaven than it is for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle. Well, I hear this story, I think it doesn't apply to me because I'm not rich, right? I'm not Bill Gates. I'm not Oprah Winfrey. I drive a used car. I live in an old farmhouse. I come from Viroqua. I'm not rich. But two things about wealth. Wealth is relative, and wealth is a matter of perception. I am, in fact, filthy rich. I am a very, very wealthy man, and sometimes that gets me into trouble. Case in point, 1990. I'm 27 years old. I've got a wonderful travel style. I like to work for 6 months, save up my money, quit my job, and go travel for a month. And then I go home and I do it all again. And I do it again and again. My 20s and my 30s, I took dozens of trips that way. On this particular trip, I pack all my good stuff into my 1980 Honda Civic hatchback. I've got a backpack full of camping gear from REI. I've got a milk crate with some really great cassettes and mixtapes. I've got a cooler full of ice and beverages and food. I've got a camera bag with one body and three lenses, and I'm good to go. I leave Minneapolis, I head west, I go straight for Rapid City. It's my first stop on this trip. I pull into Rapid City. I'm thinking, I want to have an adventure. So I'm not going to dinner at TGI Fridays in some suburban shopping mall. I decided I was going to go to the roughest part of town and find the roughest bar. This was going to be great. It didn't take me long to find the roughest part of town. I pulled into it. I parked my car there. And before I got out of my car, I got cold feet. I said to myself, do I really want to park my car in the roughest part of town with all this good stuff in it? What if somebody steals my stuff? They break the window, they take my camping gear, which is worthless, or my camera gear, and they pawn it for $75, or my cassettes, also worthless. What if they steal my journal, and they read it, and they don't appreciate my deep thought? Somewhere outside of me, related to somewhere inside of me, I could sense the presence of a little old woman with long silver hair and deep, black, compassionate eyes. She had thin, bony hands and pale, cold skin and blue veins. She reaches out and takes my hands in hers and says, "Aw, Drew, it's awfully hard to have an adventure when you're worried about your stuff. Did you know? It's harder for a rich man to go to heaven than it is for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle." Well, remembering that story pushed me over the edge. I locked the car and I left. And I didn't think about my stuff all that much for the rest of the night. As I crossed the street on my way to adventure, I was approached by a stranger, a young woman about my age, going on 60, maybe 70. She walks up to me, she says, "I'll buy you a drink if you help me find Ray's Lounge." Her name was Brenda. I said, "Hi, Brenda, I'm Drew. I'd be happy to help you find Ray's Lounge, but you don't have to buy me a drink." So off we went. I walked next to her to be respectful, to be present, to hear her and try to understand her speech, to catch her if she fell, because she seemed like she was going to fall. I stayed apart from her because I didn't want to appear to be on a date. A truck pulls up. Two guys get out. I walk up to them. I say, "Hey, guys, can you tell us where Ray's Lounge is?" They just look at me, and they look at Brenda, and they look at me like, this doesn't compute. Guy gets a big grin and he says, "Oh, sure. It's 7 blocks down this road and 1 block to your left." And they both start laughing. So off we go. And as we walk, I listen to Brenda. She tells me about life in Rapid City. She tells me about life in Pine Ridge. She talks about her parents, her deceased siblings. She talks about the child that she had that she'll never see again. She talked about the police and their cruelty. She talked about social services. And I just walked next to her and I listened. We passed the Hotel Alex Johnson. This is an 8 or 9 story brownstone building that looks like a Swiss chalet. It's fancy. It's probably the 1920s masterpiece of Rapid City's glory days. And standing outside of the Hotel Alex Johnson are, I kid you not, Buffalo Bill Cody and Annie Oakley. They are performers in perfect costumes, perfect little cowboy hats, hand-stitched Western shirts with pearl snaps. She's wearing a skirt. He's got skin-tight jeans on. They both have boots with spurs and toy rifles slung over their shoulders. I don't know, maybe it's their smoke break before their performance or after their performance or between performances. But as we walk past them, they stare at us with expressions of complete hatred. Brenda scurries. I keep up with her. Two blocks later, the police pull up. Two cops, one squad car, windows down, driving next to us, pacing us, not saying anything. Brenda tries to hide, but she can't hide. They know her. They look at me. They have no idea who I am. I think they're trying to figure us out. And thankfully, they drove off slowly. We went to the end of this seven-block route, this wild goose chase. Ray's Lounge was not there. We turned around, came back the way we came from. On the way, we passed an art gallery. We walk up to it. It's wildlife art or Native American art. Inside, you can see a bald eagle carved with a chainsaw on a tree stump. You can see paintings of beavers and bison and timber wolves. There are dream catchers hanging from the ceiling. And one giant canvas in the middle of the plate glass window depicting a proud Lakota chief standing on a mountaintop. He looks like Arnold Schwarzenegger times 10. And he's holding in his arms what I can only describe as a buxom babe clad in a buckskin bikini. Brenda points at it and says, "That's my heritage." And then she lifts her pointer finger up and points up and looks overhead, not at the sky, but at a woodcut spotlit sign that says, "The Perfect Hanging Gallery." And as she's looking up, she loses her balance, spins, and falls to the sidewalk. And I catch her, and I help her up, and for a second, she's humiliated. She looks like she's going to cry. But then she laughs, loud and long, and fills that otherwise empty side street with her laughter. Two blocks on, we found Ray's Lounge. We open the doors. It's Friday night. The place is packed. She is instantly absorbed into this crowd. She's off to find her friends, and she will buy a drink, or someone will buy her a drink. And I won't see her again, and I won't talk to her again. I'm thinking to myself, well, this has been interesting, and I don't want it to end, but I don't know if I can stay here. I look around a little bit for acknowledgement, you know, some kind of sign that there's a place for me, at least for a little while in this bar. And I get it from the bartender at the other end of the bar. He looks at me, gives me the slightest acknowledgement, and I sit down on the stool next to the exit. I reach into my day pack and pull out a notebook and a pen, not because I want to write anything, but because I want to look busy, because I'm sure nobody's going to talk to me in this place. The bartender brings me a beer. A young man comes and sits on the stool next to me. He leans into me and he says, "Are you with Brenda tonight?" His name is Jimmy. I say, "No, Jimmy, I was just walking around. I met her on the sidewalk. She asked me to help her find this place. She offered to buy me a drink, but I don't want the drink." He says, "Man, you don't ever let a woman like that buy you a drink. You let her buy you one drink, she'll suck you dry for 10. I say, "Thanks, Jimmy, that sounds like good advice." He looks at my notebook, he looks back at me, and he says, "Are you a journalist?" I say, "Well, no, not really, I'm just messing around. I have worked for a paper, but I don't now. I'm not writing a story." He says, "You're a writing man." "Yeah, maybe." "I got a story to tell you. And it begins like this. A long black cloud is following me." And for the next 2 hours, he told me his life story. 2 hours later, three beers later, I made my way from Ray's Lounge back to my car, which was intact and all of my stuff was in it. Jimmy gave me a lot to think about. Brenda gave me even more to think about. I also thought about how I had almost missed out on this opportunity to have an encounter, to meet someone, to maybe gain some understanding, because I was afraid of losing my stuff. I thought about it as I drove across Montana and Wyoming and Colorado and Nebraska over the next 3 weeks. And I'm still thinking about it today. I don't have any conclusions. All of my thoughts are works in progress. But I've got this going on. I've heard that there's a life out there, something more authentic, where people really connect, where they see each other, where they appreciate each other, no matter the circumstances. And I've heard that that life is on the other side of the eye of a needle. And on my side, I feel like a rich man or a camel, and I've got to let go of my stuff and meet people where they're at. Thank you.
Our next storyteller is so happy to be your neighbor, and we were really happy to be your neighbor for about 5 years. For the last 12 years, though, he and his spouse and their three wonderful children have been setting roots deep into the Viroqua community, intentional community. Yeah, let me put that in there. He is especially excited about having his oldest child, October, in the school as a freshman this year. We're excited to have him there because he's a spectacular soccer player, too. The title of his story is called, How Do You Say Activate Force Field in Spanish? Please welcome Kyle Bartelt.
I realized something recently. Just in the last couple years, I realized that despite having lost my mom 30 years ago, there are all these moms out there that have been raising me and taking care of me along the way over the years. So I started really trying to be more present to that and start to recognize those moms in my life. And as I look back, I see lots of those moms in my life as well. A recent example would be just in the last year when I was on a family vacation in Mexico. And the place where we were staying, I had one of the women that worked there, her name was Angela. She and I made a very quick connection, and so we spent a little time together every day talking, and we shared a lot about grief and the people that we've lost that we're close to. And I just learned a ton from her about the way that she asked and talked about her loved ones and the way she asked and talked about my loved ones that I had lost. And so by the final morning when we were leaving, Angela and I were saying our goodbyes, and I found myself standing face to face with this woman that was old enough to be my mother, and we both had tears in our eyes, and she had taught me so much. And she said to me in Spanish, "When you come back, I'll be right here waiting for you." And I was like, "Oh, it's one of my moms." So my story tonight is about another one of my moms from many years ago when I was 22 years old, and this mom helped me thread a needle. I was just starting my time in the Peace Corps and had my cohort met in Miami for a couple nights, and then we went to a touristy, smaller city in Nicaragua to start our orientation and get vaccinations, the town of Granada. And then after a few nights there, they shipped our cohort to Managua, the capital city. I have lots of moms in Nicaragua, men and women and children that are all my moms in Nicaragua, I will say, because it's just a lovely place with lovely, lovely people. However, Managua's a big city, and I am not a big city guy, despite having visited over a dozen countries at that point in my life. I had been to a lot of big cities, but was not a big city guy. So we're in Managua, and they drop us off at this hostel that's just a few blocks from the Peace Corps office, where we'll be going the next day to orient to the office and the clinic and where we can put all of our valuables. And the group that I was rooming with, it was three women and one other man. We got there and we got directions from somebody because it was time to find some dinner. And so we got directions from another volunteer that had been in the country for a while that was staying at the same hostel. And we left the hostel and we started following the directions. And we were walking and, you know, we were getting to know each other. We'd just met a couple days earlier and we're all in a new place. And we start to realize that we haven't come across any of the landmarks that we expected to approach based on the directions. But we keep walking and eventually we come to a busy street. We cross over the busy street and we walk another block or two and we're like, okay, we are not finding anything we're supposed to find in pursuit of this restaurant. So we ask somebody and they say, oh yeah, there's a restaurant just a block and a half down this side street. We're like, oh, okay, great. So we walk down to that restaurant and it's one of these, for those of you that have been to these countries that are, you know, it's the street, it's the sidewalk, and then it's the building. Block, concrete wall, building. Buildings, are, all the houses and buildings are all immediately adjacent to each other. You know, there's not boulevard and lawn between streets and houses and all of that. And then it just open air windows on the front of all these buildings that are bars for the windows and doors. And we get to the restaurant and it's awesome. We walk in and it's run by a woman and her children, her daughters and granddaughters. She is clearly the one in charge. She's got the apron tied around her waist that's got all the stuff she's going to need for the night. She's taking care of all the money. Had a great meal and excellent service. And we pay and we head out to go back to the hostel the way we came. It's dark by this time and we get about a half a block from the restaurant when from behind a kid runs up from behind us and he grabs something from Natalia, one of the women that was in our group. And she immediately starts screaming, my purse, my passport's in there. Because we were all instructed to hold on to our passports until we got to the Peace Corps office the next day where we'd be turning them in to the safe deposit box. So this kid's running off, and I'm walking with Joe, the other man, and we were kind of looking at each other, and we're like, what do we do? And we're like, well, let's try and get back. You know, it's just a kid. Let's see if we can get back what he took from Natalia. So we run after this kid. And, you know, he's probably like 13. He's not wearing shoes. He's not wearing a shirt. He's not super clean. And we catch up to him, and we're like, oh, man, what do we do? Like, what did he take? We're kind of discussing, like, you know, is he really holding anything? What should we do here? And Joe decides he's just going to trip this kid and see if we can get Natalia's passport back. And so as the kid's crossing the street, Joe trips him, and the kid takes a hard fall to the ground, and as he falls, a glass bottle breaks. It was a bottle that had the glue in it that he was addicted to, and I'll never forget this. He turns, and he looks up at us. We're standing over him now. And he turns and he looks up at us and he's just very, very scared. And it was very clear to Joe and I in that moment that we had already engaged in this situation. We were way past our boundaries on this. So we just slowly backed away. He hopped up and he took off and ran around the corner. And it was like the movies, where as soon as he went around the corner, three kids that were bigger and older than him came from around the corner. And they started yelling at us, which makes sense, right? And so we're like, oh, okay. And then we turn, and the woman from the restaurant now is out because she heard the screaming of Natalia, and Natalia's been crying this whole time. The restaurant, the matron of the restaurant is out now in the street, and she's yelling at us. I don't know Spanish yet. And so one of the other American women that knows Spanish is like, she wants us all to go back into the restaurant. And at that point, these kids that had come around the corner start throwing chunks of brick and rock at me and Joe. And so I duck into a door alcove, and I remember seeing Joe behind a utility pole, and we're like, what do we do here? And then we look past the restaurant where we need to get to, and from around that end of the block, two or three more kids come around the corner, and one of those guys has a baseball bat. And we're like, ah. So we run back to the restaurant, and we get there just ahead of all these guys. The girls from our group are in the restaurant, and the restaurant owner closes the door and locks it. And now all these guys are right through the bars, and they're yelling at us, and they're banging on the bars, and they're really upset. And we're in the restaurant, and there's solutioning going on. There's a big discussion about what we should do, and this is my time to shine. I love to figure out solutions to problems. So I am like, all right, like I'm very interested in solving this problem. I've got ideas. I don't speak any Spanish and nobody wants to listen to me, and I'm this little white guy, and this is not my neighborhood. I'm like, the back door, right? And they're like, no, there's no back. I mean, the back door is like somebody else's house. Like, we can't go out the back door. There are no side doors. And I'm like, okay, then we just wait it out, right? These guys will go home at some point. And like, the restaurant owner's like, I don't want you in my restaurant. I'm trying to run a business here. I'm like, okay. And this is all through like the American woman that was with us that knew enough Spanish to help with this discussion. We get Natalia calmed down. Turns out she still had her purse and her passport. He had taken her watch off of her wrist, and she was a little scratched up. And the instruction comes to us that we are, the woman that runs the restaurant, she tells us to open the door. And I'm like, wait a minute, wait. And they're like, no, we're done talking about it. This is what we're doing. We're going out. We're going to thread this needle right out the front door. And these guys are really mad, understandably, right? And so her daughter opens the door, and she says, stay right behind me. And so we walk out, and we walk right into the outside the building onto the sidewalk and street. And these guys are surrounding us, and she's just talking to them in a calm, quiet voice. And they're yelling, and they're upset, and they're making threatening movements with their body. And she just keeps talking to them very calmly, and she just walks us to the end of her block. And then we make the left turn, and she takes us back to that busy street. And she gets us across the street. The guys all stay over on the other side of the street. And we're all thanking her for getting us through the eye of that needle and back a little closer to home. And once again, I'm like, looking back, I'm like, okay, this is one of my moms. What did I learn from this? What's the lesson here? And I find myself, when I'm thanking her, looking at this woman eye to eye who's old enough to be my mother, and we both have tears in our eyes, and she says to me in Spanish, just don't ever come back. Thank you.
Pella Arnold.
Is that good for volumes? Okay. Oh. I have a cough drop in my mouth, so if you hear that, that's what that is. Hello, everyone. Tonight, I'm going to be telling a story about brothers and friendship. It's a story about two lives that were once sewn perfectly together and what it took for that thread to unravel. I was sitting in the back seat of my family's van, watching my brother wave from the front porch of his new home as me and my parents drove away. I just hugged him goodbye, and remember feeling in that moment, you know, so lucky, and just thinking what a tremendous gift I have been given for the past 16 years. I hadn't given much forethought to what that moment would feel like of parting ways with my lifelong companion. But beyond like the grief that came with the change in my life, and you know the pride that came with watching someone that I love take like a huge step, there was this other thing that surprised me. And navigating our way through the streets of Montreal, heading home, I remember it hitting me that this relationship, this thing that had been the most important part of my life for so long, had changed. And it had changed so much in recent years that goodbye, what should have been like this momentous and heartbreaking moment, actually felt really small. My brother and I were born a year and a half apart. We grew up on a small farm, not far from here. And the two of us, throughout our childhood, were just completely infatuated with life and with one another. We were inseparable. In fact, it's a challenge to find photos of like the two of us individually because we were just like never apart. It's always the two of us with like are matching muddy knees and missing teeth and trademark freckled faces. But yeah, I mean, we were inseparable, and life was simple for us, but it was made full by one another. And we were homeschooled, which definitely helped. During the fall and winter and spring, you know, we would sit side by side at the kitchen table, learning together. My brother would be sitting there, like at a young age, writing stories, like multi-chapter stories, about old men and like volcanic islands and like black swans and like things of that nature. And I'd be sitting next to him on the other half of the piano bench that we'd sit at, like asking him how to spell our piano teacher's name or something. And yeah, he learned how to read when he was like 4 and a half, and at that point I was like a long ways off. And because of that, he would read to me for like as long as I wanted on this big red beanbag chair in the corner of our room. And you know, we'd play soccer for like hours, regardless of the weather, barefoot in this flat part of our lawn, until our evenings would always end by like one or both of us in tears, because our game would kind of like evolve into more of like a rugby match, like a 1v1 rugby situation. But even with that, and that night, after like swearing to never speak to each other again and going to bed angry, I'd climb out of my lower bunk into his upper one, and we would talk for what felt like hours in hushed whispers, so our, you know, parents didn't hear us. And then we'd fall asleep, and we'd wake up, and we'd do it again, day after day, season after season, year after year. And this was our life. You know, yeah, he was like my other half, and myself his, and it felt like we were both like two people. And through this collaboration and competition and just like undying love for each other, we kind of developed into like this codependent symbiotic unit. And through that though, we were like never the same person. We were still very different. I think largely because of how close we were. And still to this day, like mine and his strengths like really complement each other's weaknesses. Like for example, it would have been pointless for me to learn how to read as long as I had him there to do it for me. So I thought I could kind of like let him take that one and then I could like specialize in other areas. But anyways, like as kids do, we got older, and in spite of our differences in personalities and interests, we remained like beyond best friends, and our relationship was harmonious. And then, you know, as we got older, things began to change a little bit. And for the first time, the summer after the pandemic, we spent an extended period of time apart. And he left home for 3 months. To go and join a traveling circus troupe on the East Coast. And he had entered a world that like I really wasn't a part of for the first time. And he was meeting new people and making new friends and was stepping into a new version of himself that wasn't like directly tied to me. And we didn't really have the means or the like desire to communicate much during that time. But when he returned, we had only about a week to like rediscover our friendship before this next like momentous change. Which at that time was going to school. And at this time, that's what we both wanted in terms of, you know, social things and academically. But since he was in high school and I was an eighth grader, it meant we'd be going to different schools. And pretty soon we were. We'd, you know, step out of the car in the morning and we'd walk in different directions. And pretty soon we were living sort of separate lives. And it wasn't that hard for me to begin living like he wasn't a relevant part of my life, because on one hand, I had just practiced already for like 3 months that summer. And also there was like this confused and rebellious part of myself that, you know, wanted my own version of this circus troupe. You know, wanted the own version of my identity that could grow, you know, unbounded to him. And because of this, I kind of like pushed him out of my life during that time. And pretty soon we were living lives that like, you know, sometimes crossed, but like were never fully interwoven. And even at home, things were different. You know, we were no longer sharing the same room. We were no longer going to the same soccer practices. And at this time, like that thread that had connected our lives for so long really began to unravel and loosen. And even as I entered high school and we started bumping into each other in the halls, and he like worked to fold me into his community and, you know, like welcome me into his home, you know, the stratification between our ages and identities felt even bigger. Like, I could hardly even call him a peer at that point, I felt like. But the years that followed, those high school years, you know, they were good. They were good years. They, you know, really were We both had friends and adventures, and we both grew up pretty well. But there was definitely something missing from that time. And when I think back on those days and those years, especially the two of high school, I feel like so much regret in terms of our relationship. I could sit here and try to think about what part I'm going to say next, or I could just keep telling my story. So I apologize for cheapening the moment by bringing a phone into this, but to save everybody some time. I think about like the memories that we didn't make, and the things that we didn't do more than that which we did. About all the days that I spent in my own room, working on my desk, able to hear him through the 6-inch wall that divided our bedrooms, working on his own stuff. I think about how much happier we both would have been if our relationships looked anything more similar to what they used to. Those nights spent alone, side by side, doing our own thing, I don't know why those couldn't have been spent together. If we had just been sitting on the floor of each other's room, reading each other's writing, swapping assignments to fit each other's strengths, and talking about the past, and talking about the present, and dreaming about our futures, and just continuing to know each other, collaborating, and keeping each other accountable like we used to, and laughing, and learning from each other, and even playing soccer barefoot or rugby. It's so clear to me now that exactly that is what was missing from those years. And as I look back, I can realize that I was not mature enough or not old enough or not connected to the person that I had always been to realize that and to change things. And I sort of, in a way, had lost us what could have been the best 3 years of our friendship. And now, though, as he's 1,000 miles away, and that window to return to that time has been closed since that August 2 years ago, I can remember that we still are the same people that we always were, and we are the way that we are because of each other, and in that sense, we will always be around. And that, inside of us somewhere, those two freckled boys who, you find so much joy in one another and know each other so well will always be there. And I also know that my job now, as I become a developing adult, is to find that thread I know that my job now as a developing adult, and as we both are adults, is to find that thread and sew together that relationship again. Thank you.
All right, our next storyteller. In 2017, she moved to the Driftless for her job as a professor in the Environmental Studies program at UWL. In this first week of the semester this fall, she was diagnosed with breast cancer. Now that the tumor has been removed and there is no more cancer in sight, she is hoping to ski her 7th Birkebeiner in February. The title of her story is called Tangled Up in Blue. Please welcome Margot Higgins.
I'd like to dedicate this story to two of our community members who can't be here tonight, Tamsin Morgan and Susan Nesbitt, who actually helped start this event many years ago, and all the other surrogate mamas and sisters out there. I was born blue. I took my first breath after my mother, Margot, took her last. I was premature And so I spent my first 3 weeks in an incubator being fed by tubes instead of the umbilical cord of my mother. In 1974, 449 women in this country died in childbirth, and I was one of those motherless children. My father remarried right away. As the story goes, he met my stepmother on Valentine's Day. She was a kindergarten teacher and a part-time model, and also had a damaged heart. Her father left her family when she was 12. She never got over that anger. She blamed her mother for his departure and failure to ever return to his family. So I grew up pretty blue. I was pretty sad as a little girl. I felt disconnected and lonely. So I sought vibrancy in other spaces, in other relationships. I jumped at the opportunity to go to boarding school, went to college in Maine, moved to Idaho the day I graduated, and then to Bozeman, Montana. And during that chapter, when I was 27 years old, I became an orphan. My father had a massive heart attack, and I knew he also died of a broken heart that he never mended. And I was crushed because he was a really, really wonderful father who just showed me that unconditional love I knew I probably was not going to find again. He would beam when I'd come home from school. He followed me all over the world, to Ireland and London and East Africa. He taught me how to ski. He showed up at my first skate ski races in my 20s, and I cried when I crossed the finish line, just realizing how special he was. So I lived in that fog for a number of years, and a friend at the time, an older friend, said, you gotta learn how to sit with that pain because it will pass. And it did. I spent a winter season in Yellowstone in that powdery white landscape, trekking lynx, looking at lynx distribution and abundance in that park, and I traveled to Alaska for the first time. I just spent my 21st anniversary there this past summer, and in that place, I had my first experience teaching college students in the backcountry, and fell in love with that work and that place, and pursued a PhD in California and returned there to do my dissertation work for many years. And the day after I wrapped up my field work, I had 3 grand mal seizures. And fortunately, I was 5 minutes from UCSF, and they ran a bunch of tests, a CAT scan and an MRI and an angiogram, to find a tangle of extra arteries in my brain. And so that launched a long healing process that brought in a lot of support, especially from my graduate community. My professors were wonderful. My friends, like, strung together meals for weeks on end, stayed with me, stayed in my bed with me. It was really precious. Where am I? I knew this would happen. So I healed, and I actually, I healed really, it coincided with my move here. I have been teaching UWL now for 9 years, and as I forgot, I had written up in my my intro, the first week of the semester this year, I learned that I have breast cancer, and it came as a shock. I had no idea what what my treatment plan was going to look like. At first, I thought, oh, lumpectomy surgery sucks. I've had it before, but it'll be over and done with. No. This past week, visited the Mayo Clinic for my 25th time. In that time, I have had friends show up from every single corner of my life. Going back to my kindergarten class in New York City, friends from middle school, high school, college, Idaho, both communities I lived in Montana, California, everyone has shown up in really different ways, and it's been just so wonderful to let myself be held in that space. On my 19th appointment, I think this was 11, I had a genetic test, and I learned I don't have any genetic markers, and I was just ecstatic. And my friend Tommy, who's here somewhere, said, I think you have the cancer glow. What? I think I do. And yeah, that glow has come back. But on visit 19th, I had a lumpectomy. And I had been told, everyone's got their cancer story, and I'd been told, after your lumpectomy, you feel like it's gone. You just feel this amazing space. So I was expecting that cancer glow, and I asked the surgeon, is it gone? And she said, I can't tell you that. And the other thing they didn't fully explain is that my urine was going to turn a blue raspberry shade of Gatorade. I won't tell you the other thing it looked like, but I was just like flushing this blue fluid out of my body. And I realized actually I was kind of flushing the disease away. I learned a week later that there is no cancer in the margins that they took out during the surgery, and there isn't any cancer in the lymph nodes, which is how it travels to the rest of your body. And so I had another burst of excitement. And in fact, Susan Nesbitt and I dressed up as boobies for Halloween, and I wore one very proudly that said, squeeze me, I'm cancer-free. And it actually had a squeaking device on it. I wore it to Frankie's birthday. And so I've had these multiple glows, and this past week, I met with the oncologist for the first time, and she said, you are the best cancer case I've seen in 10 years. I have this really particular tubular feature that is very rare and also very easy to treat. So I learned that, and I learned that I'm going to start radiation this week instead of needing 19 appointments like they told me initially. I will get it done in a week and 5 visits to the Mayo Clinic. So I'm just so grateful, and I'm going to borrow a quote from W.S. Merwin. I'm going to paraphrase it a little bit. It was passed on to me by a woman in this room, and it goes something like this. The absence of my parents has threaded through me this is where I want to look it up on my cell phone in my back pocket, but I'm not going to. It has shaped the texture of my life, but I think it's also expanded my measuring stick for what is also really connected and loving and joyful. I know that, and that's shown up through so many of my relationships. And so now when I think back to those first few weeks in the incubator, I realized I was being held so tenderly by the people that work in neonatal care. And I'm just so touched by that. And I think one of the biggest lessons for me in all of this has been to learn how to love harder, because I've been loved beyond what I could possibly have imagined. And so for me, that's the charm in this tangle that I continue to live. Thank you.